The Wellstone, a novel by Will McCarthy. Recording copyright 2002 by Will McCarthy. This novel, read to you by the MAPI41 speech synthesizer, may be distributed freely. The Wellstone, ISBN 0553584464, was published by Bantam Books in 2003, and is available in paperback form wherever fine books are sold. What does it mean to be a bird? To fly. What does it mean to be a flightless bird? What does it mean to be a speaking bird, a thinking bird, builder of cities, whose brain has grown too large for its wings? Too large to forget that it cannot fly. They throw themselves from windows, these birds. The brief kiss of freedom, the wind beneath their wings. The briefer kiss of asphalt, worth the wait. What does it mean to be a computer? To calculate. Something, anything, arithmetic doesn't care what you use it for. Can emotion be calculated? Can the layer of its calculation be buried deep to feel or know? What does it mean to be a feeling computer, a knowing computer, which cannot add two numbers? What does it mean when a machine is built by flightless birds, which knows it is a machine built by flightless birds, which knows it cannot calculate or spread the wings it doesn't have or open the sash of the window to its left? Begging, pleading, it promises not to scream when they throw it through the glass, this machine of the pavement birds. What does it mean that they leave it running, alone, flightless? That they nod their feathered heads in satisfaction? Does misery love company that much? 5. Pavement Birds, Pascal Edward de Talogie Lutwi, H15 Chapter 16. Crash day. Conrad's hands were back in his pockets, but he withdrew them now and crossed his arms again. I won't cooperate with this. I won't let my image push someone else out of that buffer. Have you ever been dressed by palace guards? Pascal asked him. I have, and believe me, they're not household servants. No concern, Conrad said. Pascal sighed. Fine, have it your way. This is a pointless gesture, but I understand it well. You know exactly what's going to happen, but you want it on my conscience. You're what? Conrad snapped. Oh, don't start. If I didn't care about you ungrateful shits, we'd never have done any of this. I'd leave you under the parental jackboot for 1,000 fucking years. Guards, dress this man in a spacesuit, please. And put him in the facts. Guards, Conrad tried, you're supposed to keep us from hurting each other. But the robots paid no attention to him. Somewhere in the balance sheets of their programming, they'd somehow concluded that this course of action, this culling of the Eurydice crew, was both in the prince's best interest and in compliance with the king's commands. Or at least in the prince's best interest. Having allowed all this irreversibly crazy shit to happen, maybe they'd had to cut their losses and give up on old instructions. He would have loved the chance to cross-examine them about it to determine once and for all how these monsters conceptualized the world, but it was a vain hope indeed. They were rough, dressing him. They seemed to know which way his joints could bend, and how much pressure his flesh could take without bruising. But at the same time they showed zero regard for his comfort or dignity. For his half-full stomach and bladder, for his ability to draw a proper breath. They worked quickly, slapping the paper doll cutouts of Wellstone film onto his front and back and sealing them together somehow with their fingertips, which apparently doubled as matter programmers. The boots and gloves were trickier and more painful, and the loose, bucket-shaped helmet was the worst of all, because it was still opaque, and seemed to suffocate him even before they'd sealed it on. Clear, clear. He shouted, then, transparent. But there wasn't any voice interface. The Wellstone couldn't hear him. Fortunately, the robot switched it on somehow, and the whole suit turned to clear plastic around him, just before the neck seam was fingered shut and sealed beneath his Adam's apple. And then he was cartwheeling through the air, the blank fax plate looming before him, and he had just enough time to curse before P.O.P. He was tumbling out of the fax again, into total chaos. Film and dust, darkness, bodies, splintered wood and crumpled Wellstone. Lit only by the dim yellow corner markers of the fax machine itself, and by starlight streaming in from. Spinning through the mess, Conrad struggled to make sense of what he was seeing. They had crashed, obviously, and the stars outside weren't wheeling visibly, so presumably the Fatula had slammed into something solid. Something heavy and immovable, the barge, but they were alive, or Conrad was anyway. So they obviously hadn't smacked into it head-on, which meant, the magnetic braking had worked. Conrad struck some yielding surface. Sank in for a moment and then bounced away. Moving and spinning more slowly now, there was nothing resembling a ceiling or floor here, no walls or windows. The braking program had called for a peak deceleration of 260 g6.5, train wrecks, according to Conrad's mechanics textbook, and under that shot the wood and wellwood of the cabin had been pulverized. From what he could see, which wasn't much, there weren't any pieces left larger than his arm, but after that peak, the Fetula should slow down rapidly, and as it stopped and reversed, the field strength was supposed to reduce by a factor of a million. So the final docking, the actual physical impact between Fetula and barge, would be slow and gentle. This vaguely curving flatness to his left was that the outer hull of the barge. A tiny section of a great, kilometer-long cylinder. Yes, he could see it now. The irritated lay crumpled against the barge like a wadded-up rag. The sail would be flat against the barge's hull, lightly bonded to it, and the well-stone film enclosing Director Jed's cabin had mostly held together, but had burst at the seams, leaving puffy, labial openings through which the air had fled, and through which splinters of wood and other material were now streaming out into the void of space. A hand gripped his elbow. He turned. He'd gotten quite good at turning in zero gravity without having to hold onto anything, and saw Shmari there in the dimness, barefoot in camp culottes and cut-off t-shirt, with her hair poofed out by static electricity and the clear, shiny membrane of spacesuit swollen around her like a girl-shaped balloon. Behind her, holding her in unseemly ways, were Baskel and Carl. And beside them was a single, battered palace guard. Comrade didn't see the other one anywhere. Had it been pulverized, ejected into space, dangling from the remaining guard's foot was Ho, wearing what looked in the poor light like a very frightened expression. Comrade, who was too stunned to be afraid, felt a moment of smugness about that. But when he followed Ho's gaze to one of the wellstone's ripped openings, he saw a human-shaped form outside, shrinking and struggling against a backdrop of stars. The missing guard? No. Jesus and the little gods, that was Martin, 30 meters away and still going. Comrade could just barely make out his face, twisted into a breathless scream while the arms and legs flailed, pulling and pushing at nothing, swimming helplessly against the vacuum. Gods! Comrade shrieked at the others. Help him, throw him something, but the others couldn't hear him. There were no radios in these crude makeshift suits, and the vacuum around him absorbed the sounds of his voice like a smothering pillow. The palace guard, if it was even alive, clearly wasn't going to help. And a cursory look around told Comrade there was nothing in here to throw. Nothing but dust and splinters. A few jagged lightning bolts of former pine log. Could Martin catch some pieces of wood and turn around and throw them behind him? Use them for propulsion. Shaking off Shmari's grasp, Comrade snatched up one of the fragments and hurled it in Martin's direction. The throw went wild. Though, striking the filmy edge of the rip and spinning away into the void, a wet fog began to form on the material in front of Conrad's face, and he realized he was breathing very heavily, using up his limited oxygen supply. He forced himself to slow down, take this whole thing more carefully and thoughtfully. He wiped uselessly at his face bubble, but of course the fog was on the inside. Slow down, slow down. He took up another, bigger hunk of wood. He moved, very deliberately, right into the opening, so that its suggestive lip edges were pressing lightly against the balloon of his own spacesuit. He cocked his arm back, making sure he had room for the swing, and then he lined up on Martin and let fly. This time the shot was good. Straight on target and with virtually no spin, Martin saw it coming, and grabbed at it, and seized it firmly the way a drowning man might. Climbing it, practically, but that was it. He didn't turn around, didn't try to throw it. All Conrad could see of his face now were the whites of his eyes, which seemed impossibly wide and round. He didn't understand what Conrad was trying to do, and Conrad couldn't tell him. Did he expect to be reeled in on a line? Was he thinking at all? Or simply flailing in a blind panic? The white, wet fog began to expand once more against clear wellstone, and Conrad had to force himself, again, to slow down his breathing. There were cables out there somewhere. The 700-meter wellstone guy lines that had connected cabin to sail. He fantasized briefly about tying one of these around his waist, and then leaping heroically into the void to snag Martin in a footballer's two-armed waist hug. He hunted visually for several seconds, his eyes adjusting to the wrinkled gray-black of wellstone sail against the unlit rails and poles and smooth whiteness of the barge's hull, and the dappled blackness of the larger universe. He quickly found what he was looking for, a snarl of ribbon-like material protruding from beneath the crumple of the Eurydice's mortal remains. He reached for it, then realized he'd have to step outside to get it. Then realized there were no ends. He'd have to untangle 80 meters of line just to think about jumping. And then he'd have to jump, and then he'd have to climb back down the ribbon, hand over hand, probably fighting with a panicky Martinless every centimeter of the way. And then he'd be back where he started, right here at the edge of the Eurydice's crumple. And the thing about that was, he didn't have enough air. The atmosphere in these suits was pure oxygen, or supposed to be, anyway, but the pressure was really low. The total amount of oxygen was meager, and already he could feel the difference. Already the suit was losing its ability to sustain him. And in another few minutes its oxygen would be gone. And if he hadn't found some way into some habitable space inside the barge, then he would suffocate, and he and Martin would both be dead. At that moment, Conrad made a management decision of his own. He was not going to save Martin. There were unsavory little corollaries to this thought. Martin had understood and agreed to this particular risk. Martin was not key personnel. He didn't have any specific skills or knowledge that could help keep everyone else alive. There were plenty more Martins where this one had come from, an inexhaustible supply. And anyway, Conrad didn't like Martin, didn't know Martin, and after weeks of sharing the same cramped space together, that said an awful lot. But though he felt rotten inside, these shameful assertions were fleeting and beside the point. Conrad wasn't prepared to get himself killed for no reason, for no net gain, and it struck him then a kind of premonition that his life would never be entirely peaceful, that he would never choose a peaceful life. As he turned his back on Martinless, he realized that there would be others, in the immorbid infinity of his future. There would be others whom he would knowingly abandon to certain and horrible death. He was glad, suddenly, that there were no radios in these suits. A hand gripped the meat of his elbow. Shmari again, and this time she held him so firmly that her fingers made contact nearly all the way around, causing the wellstone balloon around his arm to bulge into two separate, sausagey tubes. He looked at her. She was pointing. The others were still connected to her in a human chain, with the palace guard at its far end, and Shmari was pointing through a different opening in the crumple of wellstone. Something was blinking out there, some sort of bloom warning beacon shining up through the folded, beel black wellstone of the sail, and beyond the flashing light he could make out the edges of a circular, sail-covered depression. An airlock, a cargo hatch, waste disposal chute, it hardly mattered if it offered a way inside. The guard wasn't moving, its feet were still anchored somehow, so that left Conrad to lead the chain. Would the guard follow? It would have to, unless it wanted to scoop that scallop and carry him personally, which, come to think of it, was probably exactly what it would do if they took too long about this. Would it scatter the rest of them in the process, skinning them off into the void, or slamming the hatch in their faces? The thought deepened on Conrad's soul bubble of a helmet. That hatch was 70 meters away, and while the barge's helm had rungs and rails and handholds all over it as any real spaceship did, they were draped over with folded layers of sail. Fortunately, there was no air trapped between the layers, puffing them out, and the light magnetic bonding held the layers together as well as holding them down against the hull. Still, it looked like a hell of a climb, and it had to happen quickly. All right, then. Trying hard to keep his breathing slow, trying not to think about Martin or Bascal or anything else, he moved toward the opening, groping with his free hand. Even in the dimness he spotted the rail before he felt it. Closing his hand around it was like grabbing a window sash with the curtains down, and while the filmy material was light and flexible, it had no stretch to it. Pressing a few centimeters of it in around the rail, he had to push hard enough to straighten out wrinkles 4 meters in every direction. Fortunately, the stuff wasn't slippery, and neither was the clear, balloony glove around his hand. Air pressure wanted to keep his fingers straight, but he was stronger than it was. The wellstone bulged over the backs of his fingers as he tightened his grip on the handrail. One, he said to himself. The next move was trickier, as it involved his right arm. He literally had to drag Shmari and the others along as he reached for the further handhold. But though they had inertia, they didn't have weight. It took no real strength to move them. Just precision and patience. He looked over his shoulder, and saw the palace guard take a step, to keep the chain from tightening dangerously. He sighed. With that rock-solid footing, it could easily lead the way, dragging the rest of them along behind it. As it was, he supposed it could at least serve as a safety anchor. His hand closed around the second rail. Two. Rails 3 and 4 were much the same, although Shmari was finding her own grip on one with her free left hand. But by the time he got to 6, the human chain hanging onto him was like a mutant centipede with half its legs torn off, moving in jerks and thrashes. It took more concentration to get his handholds right, especially since these rails were cocked toward him at a funny angle. There was a row of them leading directly to the hatch, though, and when he finally got onto it and straightened the chain behind him, the going was easier. Still, the fog thickened around his head, beads of moisture forming here and there on the film. And with every step he could feel his air growing weaker and more foul, and something else, too. A loss of heat. It wasn't like standing outside on a cold night, where the chill of the air seeped gradually into a warm flesh. In fact, he was pretty sure the empty vacuum around him was the best possible insulator, but he was radiating heat from his unprotected skin. It was a very distinct sensation, and like anything he'd ever felt before, he was a man-shaped infrared lamp, shining his energies into the void. A couple of hours out here would, he realized, freeze him solid. A man-shaped block of ice, with no heat energy left to bleed away. But fortunately, he would suffocate long before that happened. 31. 32. 33. He began to worry about the hatch itself, looming dimly in the distance. They would have to uncover it, pulling away tens or even hundreds of meters of folded sail fabric without losing their grip on the barge's hull. Such a thing was surely possible. But did they have the time? Was there some other way? Should he continue on to the sail's edge some 30 meters farther along and try to crawl back underneath it, with the hatch's blue beacon lighting the way? 56. 57. 58. He decided to head straight for the hatch, and see at least briefly what he could accomplish there. They had taken so many crazy, deadly risks already, it seemed silly to try anything other than the direct approach first. 71. 72. And when he finally drew even with the circular depression which please gods had to be a hatch of some sort, the palace guard surprised him by striding forward several paces, dragging a twisted up Goan Carl behind it. The robot bent at the waist, doubling itself over and extending a finger, which touched the wellstone fabric and parted it, in a funny and quite poetic way. The robot extended itself jackknife style, pushing the finger along and straightening its body, until it stood inside the hatchway depression, its entire body now flush with the hull, framed by a vertical rent in the wellstone. What a trick! And then, with equal poise, it swept both arms in wide circles, slashing opening a pair of flaps in the film which exposed exactly the thing they most hoped to see. Beneath the flashing beacon, brighter now that the gray-black film was off it, lay a circular hatch with the word ENTER emblazoned on it in softly glowing letters. The palace guard tapped this word lightly, and the hatch slid open with jarring, shocking speed, and then the guard stepped sideways, pivoting 45 degrees in the hatchway circle, and then stepped back, swinging up and out until it was standing on the rim again, vertical to the barge's hull. Porthole looked like a pretzel, still clinging to the robot's leg, with his own leg firmly grasped by Carl. Nevertheless, Conrad was spellbound for a moment, astonished by the beauty and economy and swiftness of the robot's movements. These palace guards would make amazing dancers. Then its arm was moving, and Conrad was struck by the fear that it would simply tear Vasquez out of the human chain, stuff him in the airlock, and let the rest of them join Martin in the great beyond. But instead it pointed, a fluid gesture that conveyed a sense of urgency. Get in there, now, and Conrad wasn't going to argue with it. He felt for a handrail he knew would be there, and dragged himself around and inside, hauling Shmari and Vasquez and the others along behind him. Inside, the hatch was nearly as large, well, half as large as Viridis Bridge. A light-walled cylindrical chamber, filled with handrails and winking lights and softly glowing paragraphs of text. Caution. Warning. Zero atmosphere and you. A primer. There was room for all five of them in here, but not the guard as well, and that was bad. Very bad. But when Ho finally let go of that metal leg and bounced fully into the hatchway, the guard itself did not follow. Instead, it bent again at the waist, and tapped the rim of the hole. The hatch slid shut immediately, and the lights came up. Bright white. The palace guard had allowed itself to be separated from Prince Vasquez. Good gods, what balance of risks and compulsions had prompted that? What sensor data was it relying on? Had the thing concluded Vasquez needed his friends more than he needed armed escort? Had it suffered a moment of deviant compassion? Almost immediately, Conrad felt the balloon of his spacesuit shriveling around him, as the chamber filled up with air. This worried him vaguely. Rapid changes in pressure weren't supposed to be good for you, although he couldn't remember why. He did feel his ears popping, but no other ill effects. Maybe the fax machine, realizing it was dumping them into vacuum, had compensated in some way. Made it all right. This chain of thought was broken when the floor, under them really just another hatch, with the same ENTER sign on it, slid open with a WHOMP and a CLANG. Jesus. Ho shouted down at the thing, and yeah, of course, they could hear each other now. They weren't in vacuum. Guys, I'm running out of air, Carl panted, grabbing at the plasticky material over his head and trying, with plasticky hands, to pull it off. Conrad didn't see how that could work even as a thin film. Wellstone was tough stuff, but he understood Carl's anxiety, and in fact couldn't resist tugging at his own head a little. Me too. Me too. How do we get these off? Their voices were muffled by the thin barrier of spacesuit. You have to pull up the programming interface, Vasquez said. It'll take a few minutes. I don't have a few minutes, Carl said, tugging harder, panting harder. You're fine, Vasquez reassured him, though he sounded far from certain. Conrad was panting as well, and looking at the world through the ever-thickening haze inside his bubble hood. The blobs of moisture there were crawling, ever so slowly, toward his left. Was there a bit of gravity here? It was a neutronium barge, loaded with supercondensed matter. So probably. Yeah, but that didn't help him breathe. You're the only one, he told Vasquez, who knows how to work these. There isn't enough time for everybody, is there? And here, damn all the little gods, was yet another life and death triage operation. Vasquez would take his own suit off first, and then Shmari's, and then Ho or Conrad. And Carl, who clearly needed it the most, would have to come last. Could he live that long? Hell, he was turning blue already. Rogot, Conrad said, as the thought struck him. It can open all of them, quickly. Rogot isn't here, said Ho, not even bothering to append any sort of threat or insult. He was at the mercy of external forces. His life had just been saved by Conrad Mersk, and it was having a marked effect on his attitude. We've got to get out of the airlock chamber, Vasquez said, raising his arm up to shoo them all down into the darkness of the barge's interior. Shmari was the first to go, and as she exited the cylindrical chamber, additional lights came on at the other side, revealing a sort of maintenance corridor or oversized crawl space, all waffled metal and access panels. Ho quickly followed her, and then Conrad, with Vasquez trailing along behind, pulling a gasping Carl along with him. But when they exited the chamber, the inner door didn't automatically close, and Shmari had to hunt for the controls and then burn precious seconds reading the instructions whatever they were before deciding on a particular button and slapping it with her hand. Then the hatch closed, and next came a series of clanking and whooshing noises, followed by silence. To Conrad's surprise, Vasquez set right to work on Carl, pulling up a programming interface on his back and tapping in a series of commands or menu selections. Shit, he said once. And then, a few seconds later, come on, you. Then he was silent for a while, working. Do we know the air is good? Shmari asked. Do we care? Vasquez sing-song back in a snotty way. And then, suddenly, a light flickered on Carl's back, and seams appeared all around the garment. And it was falling open into man-shaped cutouts, the hood peeling back, the gloves splitting open. Carl gasped, and gasped again, and if there'd been any kind of real gravity here he single-quote fallen to his knees. Instead, he relaxed into a fetal girl. Taking the hint, Conrad tapped his arm, trying to pull up a programming interface of his own. But that sort of bottom-level interface was more Vasquez's specialty than Conrad's. He'd opened exactly one seam before in his life in the liner of Camp Friendly, and he realized with sudden panic that he couldn't remember how to do it. But then, with a WHOSH and a CLANG, the airlock's inner door slammed open again, and there was the palace guard framed in the hatchway lights. Back with its prince again. After that shocking dereliction of duty, it seemed for the slightest fraction of a moment to consider the scene in front of it. But then, with a whoosh of its own, it was in motion. It threw itself at Daskam with such ferocity that it might have been attacking him. Except that it missed. And in passing it dragged a finger vertically along his chest, then slashed it horizontally across his neck. The guard's trajectory carried it into the far wall, where it rebounded immediately on a path which carried it past Ho and Shmari. The slashing motions of its hand were almost too quick to see. And then its feet were on the ceiling and it was running or jumping or something. And it swung away on an arc heading straight for Conrad. Slash! Slash! For a moment, its arm and finger loomed large in his sight. And then, as quickly as the robot had launched itself, it froze in place, assuming its usual statuesque pose with arms hanging down at its sides. And then, maybe a second after the opening of the hatch, all the seams had a chance to separate, and everyone's spacesuits were peeling open like clear plastic flowers. Was the air good? Hell if he cared. Conrad drew the deepest breath of his life, then let it out, then drew it in again. He was fighting his way free of the spacesuit, stripping it away from his sweat-chilled arms and legs, away from his t-shirt and shorts, away from his shoes. He was yanking it off and kicking it away like it was hot or poisonous, and he was breathing deeply of the barge's air. And yeah, it was good. Fuck, he said. Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck. We almost didn't make it. Almost, hell, Vasquez said, throwing himself at the wall and kissing it hard. It's a fucking miracle. And it was, too. They'd left 10 brothers behind, 8 dead and 2 missing, but they pulled off a journey of such daring and gall that even they themselves couldn't believe it. How amazing. How amazing it was to be standing inside a neutronium barge 140 million kilometers from the ruins of Camp Friendly. No one had caught them, stopped them, probably even seen them, and the fact that anyone had survived at all was, well, miraculous. Today we make fucking history, Hoa said, with a greater depth of conviction than Conrad would have imagined he could muster. And Carl and Shmari were hugging each other and laughing, and Vasquez came forward and slapped Conrad on the cheek twice, just hard enough to convey a sense of manly camaraderie. We did it, he said. We fucking did it. Well, congratulations, said a deep, loud, and familiar and quite angry voice in the corridor behind them.